Welcome to Season 4, Episode 7 of the Green Data Center Podcast. Please like and subscribe, and that gives us some good feedback on how we're doing. Also, it lets you know when the next episode comes out. Plus, if you'd like to hear anything about the data center industry, we're happy to discuss here on the podcast, or we can reply directly to you. The best way to reach out, of course, is to use the website greendatacenterman.com, and there is a contact form you can fill out there. Plus, there are links to courses on udemy.com, U-D-E-M-Y.com. And if you search up data center, the courses there should come right up. But on the site, greendatacenterman.com, is where you're going to get the best, deepest discount for those courses. Plus, there are links to other data center news outlets and other sources so that you can get up to date on the latest in the data center industry. Let's go back to California. And the data center that Twitter has was knocked offline by extreme heat. Now, this comes from Peter Mudge Zatko, who was described as a whistleblower. And he's a former head of security for Twitter, but he was talking with CNN and the Washington Post about the incident. But what he goes on to state is, you know, it's alarming, yes, and he might be a little bit overinflated, but he is correct about that heat wave bringing down their data center, and they're losing their Sacramento data center region. In other words, they couldn't provide Twitter for Sacramento and whatever outlying areas that Sacramento data center services just because of this data center going down. Now, we hear a common refrain here, and this is where, when he was discussing this, there was a lot of things that engineers brought up to say, you know what, we can provide certain things that can withstand these heat waves if only you allow us to go ahead and implement some of these things. And instead, what he calls out is that instead of prioritizing the engineers' needs and the data center's needs, they prioritized instead compensation packages for, of course, their leadership. Now, what it calls out here is a weakness by the Twitter leadership that they did not listen to the engineers and they instead decided to go ahead and compensate themselves. And it's not about the greed, really. It's probably just that they don't understand data centers and the scope of the potential issue that they were facing. So, of course, they don't really see this as a threat, and why bother trying to go ahead and figure out what the issues are or try to shore up for a heat wave that may or may not happen. So they went ahead and decided to distribute the profits that they had gotten instead of this overall operational security. So let's dial it back here and just look at what can engineers do or what can the operators do to really communicate that the data center itself has certain threats. And it's not necessarily just about heat waves. It could be water shortages or other things that might jeopardize the operation of the data center. And writing a report and such, that's great. But really, the engineers oftentimes pass that up to, say, the COO or somebody else, or maybe it's just a group at a particular site or building. And how does that get passed up and presented? That's probably the biggest thing that a lot of the data center operators need to get used to instead of becoming a whistleblower later on. I know that there's a lot of people that don't have that confidence on talking about the data centers and the risk, the potential risk, and being able to flag that and being able to say, here's how much of a factor this really means on the data center operations. And the other part to that is understanding a certain operation or what might be in jeopardy of the facility itself or even of the IT equipment, and being able to say, if we have this, this is the cascading issue that this could cause. And it's not just to say that there's a single point of failure. It's just to say that, look, if we have this and this at the same time, you know, yes, that's double outage or whatever that is. But if you're normally operating and you recognize that you have an issue with, say, heat or water or fuel to your generators or whatever it might be, it's got to be raised. And that should be raised and escalated whenever possible. I'm used to a lot of the financial institutions. You think of like a Goldman Sachs or one of those other financial groups, or even like an E-Trade or one of those trading groups that if they lose their data center, they lose their capability of trading, they may as well close their doors. Well, if you think about it operating that way, in a lot of ways, these data centers and these data center operators need to look at it in the same way. Although these data centers are not tier 4, they're not super redundancy filled data centers. They're N plus one, and at, you know, at most oftentimes. And how does that play into what is affected and what the expectations are for that data center to operate? Now, of course, you can shift that load, that running amount, to another data center and do that successfully so that you have a backup data center. But that all costs money too, and it's not as simple as that. You need to make sure that you plan ahead, of course. And that's not just on the IT side, that's also on the facility side. Like, how do we make sure that if we're running at capacity, or we're starting to reach a point where we're starting to get that, you know, whether it's too warm or whatever the case might be, how do we make sure that we can do that and transition safely for all of the personnel, the IT, everything, the information isn't lost and nothing goes down? A lot of groups, of course, will just point to the cloud and say, well, there's our solution, and that's how we're going to handle this. Well, that's great. That's one effective way to go ahead and shore up any sort of weaknesses that you might have, is to look for others to pick that up for you or with you as a team. But of course, you want to point that out early, and you don't want this to be a lesson learned. You want this to be a case where you solved an issue before it ever happened. And sometimes that's looking to what others' mistakes have been. So for those who have followed up with Twitter, and we're probably going to see more in the coming weeks about that outage, as well as the other outages that happened in the UK, we're probably going to learn a lot about what the active data centers were doing, what their original plans were, what if they had a heat wave or whatever condition that they ran into, and what did they do to mitigate that going forward, so all the other data center operators can therefore go through through such heat waves. And we'll go back to London really quickly just to mention that even though a couple data centers there failed, there's a lot of data centers in London and across the UK that did not come down or cause major outages. So of the famous ones that did come down, maybe there's others that had to restrict usage or that kind of thing. And maybe that's their mitigation plan, is to do just that or to offsite it. And all of that, of course, leads to not getting in the news. You don't have your data center come down, and therefore you keep yourselves out of the news, you keep yourself operating, and therefore you can just turn on and keep going whenever that heat wave ends. Let's go into education, as 3/4 of the data center operators and owners out there have programs that are geared towards bringing in young people or new talent into the industry. You might have heard a lot about, like, the Navy nuclear programs, that all of these Navy nuke guys that come out of the Navy are looking for different programs, and they are automatically offered all sorts of data center jobs because they generally understand operational redundancy and what it takes to keep things going in a data center, very much similar to how submarines are done. And I've heard a lot of analogies done with that. So it is one of those places where a lot of those operators start to come from that industry. But there's more and more approaching colleges and universities looking for that young talent to come into the industry as well. But really, what we're looking at is a big wave of new data centers coming online, as well as a lot of people retiring. So suddenly we're in that crux of constantly looking for people to hire. And there's a lot of groups that are looking to do that. Well, how do you entice that talent? How do you manage to get people interested and understand even the business of data centers themselves? In a lot of ways, the way the industry itself has looked at data centers is, let's not talk about that too terribly much. Let's keep ourselves out of the news and out of something busy where we're going to attract a lot of attention. And that's been the commonplace theme with data centers, no matter who's owning and operating them. But more and more, we're seeing big names across big news corporations, and we're seeing a lot of that M&A, that mergers and acquisitions, create large companies that are attracting a lot of attention. And of course, data centers keep growing year by year, along with the information, the data, the storage, everything that goes along with it. And if you have a data center company that can provide the data centers and the services that can be provided with them, then you've probably got yourself a pretty good company set up to go ahead and be available on whatever stock investments and stock market. And that, of course, is appealing, especially whenever you can provide solid jobs. And a large company can do that, and even the small companies in the data center space can do that, and do that very well and very nimbly. So if you are looking for that talent, well, what are the things that you can do? Well, one of those is to host a tour, and that can be in person or virtual. And you can take that virtual tour because a lot of people post-COVID here are still very comfortable staying at home and leaning back in their office chair and watching a virtual tour of a data center. But the actual tours are something to coax people to do, because until you see the size of some of these facilities, you might not get it. You might not understand. And depicting that on a camera or just with pictures can be hard to do. So you can show people around and knock on the hardware, knock on the equipment, and show people the walls and such. But until you have people standing against it, or you can take that in with your own eyes, sometimes it doesn't really click. Then you also need to talk about what people are doing for the data center. What are the given tasks or the things that happen from day to day? And that could be simple, hey, we're doing an expansion, or guess what, we're doing this swap out of a rack, or we're doing this upgrade, whatever that is. Or if it's just construction of these facilities, all of that can be depicted and understood, whether you're giving that tour virtually or in person. But that really starts to solidify what people understand about data centers and the data center industry. The other big thing is just to talk about how much growth potential there is here. A lot of people worry about job security, and that's one of the big things here, is what are the potentials for job security, but also, you know, what are the advancement potentials and where can I go from here? And just talking about some of those things that you can springboard from a certain opening or position that you might have. And, you know, a lot of people might be used to hearing about, well, you know, you get your junior's license, or you get your journeyman, or whatever that is. And it takes 2-3 years before you're able to do that. And then a couple more years before you can get your master's license or and such. In the data center industry, year by year, you are springing forth because you are looking at a lot of these different things in a lot shorter period of time. And that means the advancements can happen in a shorter period of time as well. On top of that, you also, with a tour, can look at the different people and what their tasks are through a given day and who you might interact with and see. And usually whenever you're talking with them, and might not come through obviously, but you do have that sense of that purpose and why it matters what they're doing through that data center, and what it means if they don't do it, if somebody doesn't get to it, and what that can mean for others, and how it works together as a major team and everybody being on the same page. And that can all start with just, how does the internet work? Start from there and say, look, we are hosting certain services by these internet companies, and go ahead and drop a name or two if you can, and just say what you're doing for them, what you're providing for them, and if you weren't there, what would happen? Sure, maybe there's another data center that could pick up the slack, but there's a reason why they're there. It's because they need the help of that particular data center, the people involved there, the services that are involved, in order to keep things operational and going day to day. Now, the other part to this is, you might be talking with people, or if you can get in front of people to talk with them about that data center and what that's about, and you don't even have a tour, but if you can go out and talk to a classroom of engineers or people that are in high school and their options, that what they're considering going into or what they want to do maybe in the coming future, this can be an excellent opportunity for you to say exactly what happens in the data center and how that helps the internet stay up and going. And of course, you don't have to be a teacher. Teachers will tell you all the time, it's great to see when their eyes widen and they, you know, things start to click. But oftentimes that's not what happens. They go home, they think about it, and they say, oh, you know what? I'm turning on my computer, or I'm turning on Netflix, or whatever it is. And it will start to click behind the scenes when you're not there, and it'll get them thinking about the data center and what they can help provide in the industry. And the idea is, you also keep yourself available for their outreach. So if you did go talk to a classroom or you did host a tour, follow up, make sure that you're going ahead and doing that second outreach, because that can be the difference between you getting candidates in the door and just sort of, you know, waiting for them to go ahead and try to introduce themselves to you again. And that can, of course, you know, be a disconnect that can be bridged easily if you have a means to go ahead and connect with them again. At the colleges and universities, that can simply be done by just having that roster of people. And if they want to submit a resume, if they want to go ahead and reach out to you, that's one way that they can do that. But also keep in touch with those instructors if you can get in touch with them as well. Sure, the instructors will have that list, that email list of all their students. And it's one thing to send out an email blast. It's another to have the instructors recommend some people as well. So there might be people that followed up with the instructors or teachers or whomever and said, you know what, we have a couple candidates that are expressed some interest, or they had even a follow-up question or two, or they said, oh yeah, you know, there was something cool about that that might be worthwhile. That can be gold as far as finding extra talent that you can go ahead and see if they're really interested and follow up with. And it'll take less time than a lot of other outreach methods. Now, I did skip some steps here. And, how do you get in front of those college, university students or those high school students? Well, go ahead and reach out to the counselors. They will go ahead and understand that need, especially if you're able to brag about the data center industry and its growth over the last decade or so. And they'll start to understand, oh, this is something that's going to be huge, and they're looking for talent, and they can go ahead and start to point to people or point people your way in order to go ahead and have that. But you can go ahead and reach out to them to say, look, can I have 15 minutes to show up at this high school and talk to this group of math students in the early morning or in the late afternoon or whatever that case might be, and talk to them about the opportunities that are out there for them. And therefore, it's, you know, if you can get in front of them and talk to a couple, great students that might be out there in whatever class that might be, you can start to understand where they're at and that their career options are wide open. Colleges and universities will have that same opportunity as well, so you can reach out to some of those professors directly. Sometimes that's the easiest way, especially if you keep in touch with any of them, and they might be able to let you go ahead and take one of their lecture classes for, say, half the class, 20, 30 minutes to talk with them about data centers and what it's about. Now, that's a lot of that young talent, but there's other ways to reach out as well, and that's with networking, especially with understanding where, say, people are looking for a career change or transition. And there are local economic development groups with counties or with certain groups or regions, and you can plug into them to see, look, we are looking for more talent in this particular data center industry, and we know that there's a lot of tangential industries, say HVAC techs, and we could really have a lot of technicians from certain industries like that transition over to help out the data centers. And it won't take that long on training, as a lot of the principles are generally the same or transferable, so they can go ahead and get plugged into the data center industry rather easily. Let's talk about a recent switch by Ethereum, the cryptocurrency, from their move to proof of stake from the previous proof of work system. Now, this has been a shift that's been coming and has been talking about for a while, and a lot of people are saying, well, maybe that's not really going to happen. But what this means on that proof of stake system is that instead of needing a lot of these GPUs and farms that consume a lot of calculations, which are essentially pointless in order to go ahead and do that proof of work, and they calculate all of the calculations in order to prove that something can be verified much more easily, they are instead reducing that by terawatts of energy per year. So if you had a lot of cryptocurrency mining around Ethereum, it's over. That piece is over. Now, Bitcoin is still going, so go ahead and switch up if you've got some coin mining or, any cryptocurrency mining going on. But it was using about 72 terawatt hours of energy a year and growing. And that's according to several economists. And it was estimated that this will bring it down by more than 99%. Which is a huge drastic shift as far as the amount of energy to be reduced. Now, what we're talking about for drastic is it's estimated, and if you look at the total amount of worldwide electricity demand and use, it's almost a 0.2%. So it's not a complete percent, right? It's a 0.2% of the world's electricity demand going away. So suddenly that big shift makes things that much better and more efficient overall. Now, what we have to realize is all those miners out there are going to instead probably just switch to other mining activities. So, Yeah, as good as we want to tout that, it's probably going to be them switching over to Bitcoin or Ravencoin or Beam or Ethereum Classic. Yes, there's an Ethereum Classic among the many, many others that are out there. But given that there's a lot of cryptocurrency prices that are on that downward trend, and there's been some, you know, cliff diving drops, but it's been kind of a slow and steady sort of drag down over, you know, the long term here over the last year or so. And that's forced a lot of the other companies to evaluate where they're going and where they're going in the future and decide to make that change and get out of the cryptocurrency game altogether. So this hasn't been something that's, you know, new. Everybody knew that this was coming with Ethereum. So the cryptocurrency market was starting to get flooded with all these second-hand, third-hand GPUs and miners. And that's led to a big downturn on the amount of manufacturing of the miners, or basically the GPUs and such. So all of those GPUs that we saw that were being devoted strictly to cryptocurrency mining, and therefore you couldn't buy you know, GPUs and other miners that easily. Instead, we're starting to see just that flood keep continuing. And with Ethereum essentially dropping off as this huge cryptocurrency, and a lot of other cryptocurrencies just aren't as efficient as Ethereum, or you're not getting as much as Ethereum, you're basically not going to be mining those other currencies. You may as well go ahead and sell or switch to one of the others that you're hoping to at least get some payback on. Now, of course, Ethereum is a proof of stake that was proven before Ethereum switched to this. So the proof of stake isn't a new concept. It's something that they finally switched to, and they are definitely looking at that as an advantage. It does keep it decentralized, and there's a lot of people that are worried about the security of that proof of stake, but that's already been debunked with any security concerns as much as any other cryptocurrency. So with Ethereum sitting at about $200 billion of total worth and maybe climbing, maybe dropping, we'll see. But it's probably not going out anytime soon. But Ethereum is starting to take the lead on being one of the more efficient ones that is the largest. And they can look to do other improvements that are going to support transactions or making and keeping it decentralized and still keeping up security and not having to worry about having all this crypto mining to do proof of work in order to stay stable. Now, how does Ethereum stack up against a lot of these other coins that are out there on the efficiency side? Well, looking at some of the others that have been out there for a little bit, there's one called SolarCoin, and it operates strictly the same way as a regular cryptocurrency, but you are awarded a SolarCoin, one SolarCoin for every 1 megawatt hour produced. So based on that, you can go ahead and have solar panels, whether you're a large company or just a small provider, whatever, or just on your own home roof, and you can generate solar coins. And of course, those can be traded and such. So you need to go ahead and upload the documentation that shows how much energy you got over what period of time in order to go ahead and cash in and get that cryptocurrency. So there is a manual sort of documentation thing that's part of that. But if you can go ahead and establish that, say on a monthly basis or even a yearly basis, you're looking at cashing in on some solar coin, which may be used more and more. It can definitely be used like any other cryptocurrency, and you can put it on a cryptocurrency exchange and exchange it that way. So ideally, you could cash in that way a little bit more easily. Another one that the co-founder of Ethereum has come up with is Cardano, and that's been a proof of stake since the beginning. And one of the reasons that came up this way is to be faster on the transactions. Now, it's proof of stake means that it's much more efficient, but it's also got exchanges that can do 1,000 transactions per second, while Bitcoin is about 7 transactions a second or so. Now, there are those that can also be mined in the cloud, for instance, Chia, and it's not as well known, but it's one of those that you can go ahead and farm Chia efficiently, quickly, right out of the cloud, so you don't really need to go into the whole crypto mining business in order to start farming this way. Now, what makes this a little bit more interesting is it's called a proof of space-time model. What is that? Well, if you read about that, like I had to, you're storing a certain amount of data for a specific amount of time. Based on that, That's what you're looking at for generation. And you can go ahead and mine that chia efficiently, quickly that way. And you're not draining anything on the environment. You're not having that extra energy consumption, etc. So this is, again, one of those efficient ones. It's probably going to start replacing a lot of those proof of work concepts. And the more this takes off because it's cloud-based, it's probably going to grow just based on that alone. So looking forward to seeing what chia can do in the near future as well. Now, let's pivot a little bit to talk about NFTs, right? And of course, people have been talking about NFTs for artwork, but it's not just used for artwork and digital things. It's used for certificates of ownership of all kinds, of all digital kinds, I should say. And that means music, videos, tokens, items, whatever the collectible thing might be, whether it's sports related or game related or whatever that is. We're talking about NFTs being produced, and they're going to be blockchain related. So if you have that as an NFT on a blockchain, and it's very much supported by one network or another, in the case of most NFTs, they're Ethereum based, which means that they're about to get much more efficient, but they still have a number of transactions that can be sapping on the overall energy use across the world. And it's not just the ones that are huge, it's all of the ones that are produced. So if you think about how much is being produced everywhere, the NFTs are another growing legion. Aside from cryptocurrency, we're likely to see take off with blockchain. NFTs are also going to be among the pieces and parts of the metaverse as it's coming online and growing. And I should say metaverses, plural, because the metaverse from Meta is not the only one that's out there that people are building. But there's other things, and blockchain gaming and other things are becoming more and more popular, and it's ramping up quickly. So we're likely to see a lot of that happening with the NFTs being part of that and also requiring a lot more energy in order to support. Now, because Ethereum is switching, it means that the major platform, Ethereum, being used for all these NFTs is also switching. And this doesn't affect every one of them, though, so you have to kind of pay attention to which one is being used. But NFTs, because they were using Ethereum, they were looking at about 48 kilowatt hours per NFT. And that equates to about a day and a half in the U.S. household, or a week, or a week and a half, depending on where you're at in the rest of the world, as far as the amount of energy use. So, and that was because it was more of a proof of work. And if you have that type of, that consensus algorithm that uses that much energy, it's not the NFT itself, it's the network that you're using. So if we drop that by 99%, suddenly instead of 48 kilowatt hours or 48 point whatever kilowatt hours, you're dropping to less than 1%. And, as stated, we're dropping it by 99%. That's kind of a conservative measure, actually, for Ethereum. So it's likely to drop much more than that. And we're probably going to have overall Ethereum and everything that it supports as networks basically drop the amount of energy that they're using. So these reports on the NFT generation and that explosion that's about to happen, and seeing that as a major upset or major worry for the energy use in the world is probably not really valid. And Ethereum just switching again to that proof of stake instead of work is going to be the big reason why that's avoided. So if you're worried about generating another NFT based on the latest crayon drawings that your children might have created or whatever that is, don't fret. Go ahead and make some NFTs and share them with everyone that you want. It doesn't mean they're going to retain value, but what it does mean is they're not going to really use any energy consumption, and that's by comparison. But overall, you have an NFT now. Congratulations, you're part of that marketplace and you have something that is non-fungible. In other words, you cannot you can't mess with it any longer, and it is yours digitally to share with others. And the ownership of that is yours into the future, unless you decide to sell, of course. So we'll see a lot more NFTs available on Metaverse and everywhere else into the future. And everyone will, of course, not just share pictures, but anything that they might be able to create. So it does protect those that are looking to create something and not have it just automatically sort of go out to the internet and be, quote, stolen, so to speak, and shared by everyone else. Instead, you can go ahead and have that NFT and you can keep that and claim that as your own. And then not be worried about how much energy it takes to go ahead and generate it or to trade it. Okay, season 4, episode 7. If you'd like to hear anything about the data center industry or green data centers in general or the upcoming technologies that you'd like to hear about, feel free to let us know and go to thegreendatacenterman.com and fill out the contact form. And like and subscribe. That like lets us know that we're doing what you like to hear, and that subscribe means that you'll get to hear the latest episode whenever it comes out on whatever platform that you might have. Also, the website has links to udemy.com courses that are going to be the best, cheapest out there that you can find. And also, we've got some upcoming events on the website as well. So go ahead and check that out and see if there's anything coming to a city or location near you. We hope to see you at one of those events in the near future. We'll look out for your NFTs on the new efficient Ethereum platform soon.